All right, welcome to episode 637 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And in today's podcast, I'm going to be discussing something I title USMLE Mechanisms and Patterns. USMLE Mechanisms and Patterns. This podcast is a little bit weird because it's not like a traditional podcast like what I make. But there is going to be a lot of nuance that is discussed here that I think can be very helpful to you as you're preparing for your exams. Because the thing is, a common problem many people fall into in preparing for their exams is they're like, okay, you know, Divine, I've done everything. You know, people have said do 5,000 questions or whatever and you'll be fine. I've done all the questions. I've learned the buzzwords. I've learned the classic vignettes. I've matured every hanky-dank known to mankind. And I'm still not doing well on my practice exams. I'm still not doing well on my tests. Like, what's going on, right? Like, I noticed that I've done all these things, but I'm still sitting down taking my exam, and I feel like I'm reading a foreign language. Like, what's going on here? Like, what in the world is going on here, right? So the goal of this podcast is to address why that may be the case for some people, and also try to give you some strategies for countering those problems. Because the thing is, the USMLE exams, they are not exams that are rooted solely in you just knowing content. It's also rooted in you knowing certain patterns, right? Certain patterns, certain mechanisms, so that you can set yourself up for success as you take the exam, right? Set yourself up for success as you take the exam, right? And the very first thing I think I'm going to start off by saying is this, and you're going to see this reflected as we go through many of these things. Again, don't run away. I promise you this is going to be worth your while. And this podcast is going to help anybody studying for step one or step two or step three, right? But the first central thing I'm going to say here is this. Focus on mechanisms over memorization. Focus on mechanisms over memorization. The thing is, you're just going to get much farther and you're going to get more from the knowledge you have when you have mechanisms understood. That's the truth, right? You're going to get a lot more, right? So the thing is, let me explain what I mean. Two people can have the same fund of knowledge, but they get different exam scores. Two people may have the same fund of knowledge and they may approach the same question in completely different ways. Why? Because one person has the fund of knowledge that was built solely on memorization, but the other person has a fund of knowledge that was not just built on memorization, but was built on an understanding of mechanisms, right? Was built on an understanding of mechanisms. The thing is, you can learn glycolysis by just blindly memorizing information, or you can learn glycolysis and learn the mechanisms behind it. It's like, hey, why does this specific reaction go and why does this specific reaction not go? Like, why does it happen this way versus that way, right? You'll notice that when you have a good fund of knowledge that is backed up by an understanding of mechanisms, it's almost like you have $5 of knowledge, but you can get like $25 of utility from it. Right? So those people end up being more successful on their exams versus a person that has like a $5 fund of knowledge and they can only get $5 out of it, right? Let me explain how that may play out on an exam, right? So the thing is, say for example, you see a novel situation that you've never seen before. You're like, man, this situation, I've literally never seen this before. But the thing is, because you understood the concept from something completely unrelated, you're somehow able to approach that question and get it right. That's very different from a person that, hey, they just have a fund of knowledge backed up mainly by memorization. But if there is anything that is done on the USMLEs that goes beyond the boundaries of what they are used to seeing, that fund of knowledge they have, they cannot get extra use out of it, right? Because it's like, wow, this is not the scenario that I memorized. This is not what I've seen in my Q-bank. This is not what I've seen in my Anki deck. So they have like no basis for approaching that question. But when you have mechanistic understanding, you have a basis for approaching even an otherwise difficult question. Even if it's something you've never seen, you can still do something about that question. Guys, this first point I'm making is extremely important. Is extremely important because it's one pattern. It's pattern number one I'm going to address today. Pattern number one are questions that reflect material you have never seen before, right? And let me tell you this. This is the reality of the USMLEs. There will be some questions. Again, I'm not going to say that it's going to be a pervasive number of questions, but there will absolutely be some questions on your exams that you see where you're like, I have never seen this concept before, right? If any tutor or any teacher tells you that, hey, after I teach you, everything you see on your exam, you're going to recognize, that person is a liar. Even I cannot make those kinds of claims. Because when I took my USMLE exams, there were questions that I saw where I was like, what in the world is this? What in the world is going on right now, right? Again, one of the most effective prophylactic strategies against that pattern is being able to understand mechanisms, right? So go with mechanisms over memorization. I'm telling you this, don't be afraid in the learning phase of content to really dig deep. If you dig deep, you will learn. If you learn, you can apply that knowledge to a wide variety of scenarios. But if a person just memorizes, right, they don't dig deep. They don't understand the mechanisms. They emphasize memorization over mechanisms instead of mechanisms over memorization. They're going to run into certain situations on the exams where it's like, wow, okay, this concept, the USMLEs somehow magically expect you to get this question right, right? And again, you think it's probably unfair, but the thing is, no, it's rewarding the people that put in the time to learn mechanisms. You may think it's unfair, but you know what? Let me tell you this. Sometimes life is not fair. Suck it up. Deal with it, right? So it's just very important to keep this one pattern in mind, right? There are going to be questions you're going to see on your exams that you've never seen before. The best way you can prepare for those things is understanding mechanisms, right? Because, you know, sometimes in my classes or sometimes in my one-on-one tutoring, somebody will ask me like, Divine, this content that I'm seeing on this question, how could I have prepared for that? Well, I tell them that, hey, see, and sometimes it's even a hard question to answer. But honestly, the best way to answer those questions is emphasize mechanisms over memorization. I think I've kind of hit this point pretty hard. So I'm going to go ahead and go to the next point. You know, like, for example, like, you know, before I maybe hit the next point, you know, like things like, for example, is like, why is it that when your red cells, your get to the lungs, they give up carbon dioxide and are able to take up oxygen, right? Like, there's like molecular mechanisms behind those things, right? There's molecular mechanisms behind those things. It's like, hey, it's like, you know, there is histidine, and histidine is a good buffer at physiologic pH and all those things, you know, like, but these are things that you almost see like no research talk about. You almost see like no Ankydek talk about. But the thing is, it's little details like this that sometimes can explain many things, right? And the thing is, many people ignore these things because they're like, oh, it's a little detail. It will not be tested on my exams. So here's the thing. They may not directly test that little detail on your exams, but an understanding of that seemingly small detail, it can help you control more knowledge, right? It can help you control more knowledge. Like, guys, I know that this podcast I'm saying, it kind of sounds weird, but this stuff I'm telling you, like, as a person that has taken all the USMLE exams and I've tutored thousands of people for the USMLE exams, I know what I'm talking about in relation to this. I'm not trying to be proud. I'm trying to be honest with you, right? I'm trying to be honest with you. If you learn mechanisms, you can control a larger body of knowledge than a person that does not understand mechanisms, right? A person that doesn't understand mechanisms, they can only control what they know. That's it, right? They cannot apply what they know to novel situations, right? That's part of the critical thinking that the test demands. So just kind of keep those things in mind. All right. Now, another classic pattern on the USMLE exam. So I've talked about pattern number one, emphasize mechanisms over memorization. Another pattern that I want to emphasize on, in relation to the USMLEs are things I like to call cloaked questions. Cloaked questions. What do I mean by a cloaked question? A cloaked question is a question that, you're reading the question and everything kind of starts off fine. And then over time, things then begin to deteriorate hard, right? This is a classic question pattern you may see on your exams, right? So like, for example, let me give you some examples of this question pattern, right? So like, for example, you get a question about a newborn, right? The newborn had phenomenal apgars at birth. The newborn was completely fine, right? And then you know, like 12 hours after birth, 24 hours after birth, the child starts sweating with feeds, right? Or the child starts becoming profoundly hypoxic and you're giving this child supplemental oxygen and it's not helping. That's a very classic presentation of a cyanotic congenital heart defect, right? Of a cyanotic congenital heart defect. The thing is, why do I put this under the pattern of cloaked questions? The thing is, sometimes people are not, they don't even pick up on this at all because they're like, oh, everything seemed fine, right? And then why did things go bad? That's a cloaked question. That's a cloaked question. Another classic cloaked question example is the inborn errors of metabolism, right? So you notice, you know, the baby is completely fine at birth. They go home, right? And then a few days, few weeks later, the baby just starts crashing and burning, right? They start becoming lethargic. They start having poor feeding. They start having vomiting. They start having seizures, right? Many times they'll have a distinct smell. Right? When you see this, think of an inborn error of metabolism. It's a kind of cloaked question, right? So the fact that something starts off right for a child does not mean that things are going to stay right, right? Because the thing is, when you're in the womb, mom does a lot of the heavy lifting for you, right? Literally, her metabolism handles practically everything, right? If the baby cannot process things, guess what? Just outsource your problem to the placenta. The placenta is going to deal with it for you. Right? But once the baby starts feeding independently, metabolizing independently, then that inborn error of metabolism, that enzyme defect they have, it becomes apparent. It begins to show up, right? It begins to show up, right? So like, just keep this in mind. This is something that like this cloaked question business is something that shows up a lot in pediatrics, right? So like, you know, like PKU, a child that has PKU is not going to, is going to be completely fine in the hospital. But it's a few days, a few weeks after they've gone home, you're going to start seeing problems, right? Same thing with maple syrup urine disease, right? Where you have an issue with branching chiral acid dehydrogenase, right? Again, child's going to be completely normal at birth, but as they go home, as they stay home for a few days, you start seeing problems. Galactosemia, same deal. Same deal, right? Same deal. Galactosemia is going to be the exact same deal, right? Galactose-1-phosphate uridyl transferase deficiency. Again, they start off fine, and then they get a few, you know, rounds of breast milk under their belt, and then they start having problems, right? So again, baby is fine at birth, right? Baby is fine at birth, right? And then things start deteriorating. When you see those things like that, think of an inborn error of metabolism, right? The thing is, the USMLE is when they want to cloak things in adults, many times they will give you like an offshoot presentation of a main disease, right? In fact, let me just maybe make this pattern number three, cloaked presentation. Right? Offshoot presentation of a main disease. Let me explain what I mean by offshoot presentation of a main disease. By offshoot presentation of a main disease, I mean that, hey, there's a main disease, but they take an offshoot of it and test just that offshoot. That's a very good way to cloak a concept and make people not realize that, oh, this is what this person is testing, right? Like, I give you a classic example of this. A good classic example will be testing, let's see. Let me try to think of an example. Again, sorry, this is kind of off the cuff. So I'm trying to, you know, think of an example here. But a good example will be something along the lines of, okay, so let's say, for example, a person has giant cell arteritis, right? Person has giant cell arteritis, and then they get in an accident and become profoundly hypotensive, right? And they tell you that, hey, this person has been given fluids and all that stuff, and it's not, their blood pressures are just not budging at all, right? And then you notice that the right answer is adrenal insufficiency, and you're like, what in the world is this? Well, that's where you need to start making links, right? The concept was cloaked by GCA, right? Because our friends at the MBMEs, they know that, oh, people think, oh, GCA, you know, woman over 50, right? She has like unilateral eye pain, unilateral headache, right? Sometimes you may see the association with polymyalgia rheumatica, right? That's what most people know about GCA. And hey, you know, they can go blind. It's a large vessel vasculitis, blah, 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 blah. People know those things. That's fine, right? But they can use it as a way to test adrenal insufficiency. Well, where's the link? Well, think about it. When a person has GCA, they have to be on high dose steroids for months, right? That's going to suppress ACTH production. If you suppress ACTH production, that is literally going to stop your adrenal cortex from being stimulated, right? But again, that's not a problem as long as you're facing the same level of life stress. But if things change, surgery, medical illness, accident, studying for the USMLEs, you know, something really stressful with your life. I mean that as a joke, right? But something really stressful comes into your life, then your body's going to be like, oh, I need to make more cortisol to deal with this new stress. If you're still taking the same dose of the steroid that you've been taking, well, that's not going to help. And then you're like, oh, maybe my adrenal cortex can ramp things up and make more cortisol. Well, how can it ramp things up and make more cortisol when it's undergone atrophy because it's not being stimulated by ACTH? Your zona fasciculata, right? It's like, it's not working anymore because ACTH, the trophic factor for it, is not working, right? So just keep that in mind, right? So you're like, man, I never thought I could get an adrenal insufficiency question out of giant cell arteritis, right? And that's the thing. That's part of what informs the way I make my podcasts, right? Many people, they want a podcast. Like, people are probably going to love me more if I have a podcast where I teach things in linear fashion. Like, okay, this is the definition. This is the clinical presentation. These are the risk factors. This is how you treat it. But to be honest with you, if I do that for you, I'm not helping you. Like, then you shouldn't be listening to my podcast. You can go, like, there's many resources out there that can literally do that exact same thing for you, right? I'm not adding any value to your life if that's precisely what I'm doing. But if I integrate things and give you these cloaked vignettes and you're like, wait, how did Divine get off in this direction from this one topic? I've never seen this link before. Then I'm really helping you to prep for your exams because you're seeing things in multiple dimensions, right? That mode of thinking will help you deal with that kind, those kinds of problems on your exams, right? So that's pattern number three, right? A question that is cloaked by testing an offshoot presentation of it, right? Testing something that is completely offshoot, right? So just going to keep that in mind. Hopefully, like, as I'm giving you these examples, this makes more sense, right? And then pattern number four is what I like to call the relevant detail, right? The relevant detail, right? The thing is, you may notice that some people think that they understand certain things, but there's just like some relevant details that are just, number one, either omitted from many study resources, or number two, people just never learned them in the first place. And then they're like kind of wondering, like, why is it that I've never been able to break through with this particular concept? Or they present some questions on the exams relating to this thing and I'm like completely falling apart. What's going on here? Well, the reason there is that you may have learned so many things about a topic, but there's like a relevant keystone detail that you have not learned. If I'm going to call this pattern four, the keystone pattern, right? So like, for example, a classic example I've seen in many, many situations is that many people don't understand how digoxin works. They literally don't. And the truth is, many resources do not go into the relevant keystone detail of how DIG works, right? So it's like, for example, it's like, wow, why is digoxin a positive inotrope? Well, it inhibits the, many resources are going to stop at, it inhibits the sodium-potassium ATPase pump and raises intracellular calcium. That's all many people talk about. That's it, right? But the thing is, if that's all you teach a person, they are missing out on certain keystone pieces of information that can end up being a very useful differentiator with a tough exam question, right? Because think about it. The cardiac cell doesn't just have the sodium-potassium ATPase pump. It has the sodium-potassium ATPase pump, but it also has the sodium-calcium exchanger, right? So think about this. This is like a cascade. If you block the sodium-potassium ATPase pump, then sodium is not going to leave the cardiac cell anymore. Because what does this pump do? The sodium-potassium ATPase pump, right? The sodium-potassium ATPase pump, it does two things, right? It pumps three sodiums out of cells and brings two potassiums in. Give me a quick moment. I want to write something down so I don't forget. Right? Okay, so sorry about that, right? So it pumps three sodiums out of cells and puts two potassiums in. That's what it does, right? So if you inhibit it and it stops working, then sodiums will not leave the cell. So your intracellular sodium concentration is going to rise. And as your intracellular sodium concentration rises, guess what? The sodium-calcium exchanger is going to stop working. Well, what does the sodium-calcium exchanger do? The sodium-calcium exchanger brings sodiums into cells, and then that gradient energy of sodium, as sodium is rushing into the cell, you're coupling that to the active transport of calcium out of the cell, right? So if you raise the intracellular concentration of sodium, then that sodium-calcium exchanger that depends on the gradient energy of sodium to work doesn't work anymore. So you can no longer extrude calcium from the cell. So you're going to have a rise in your intracellular calcium. And that's responsible for the positive inotropy that we see with digoxin, right? And the thing is, it does not just explain the positive inotropy. It also explains some of the side effects we see with digoxin, right? Like, for example, like the after depolarizations and all those things, the arrhythmias and that it can cause, right? The atrial tachycardia it can cause, right? Or, you know, the fact that digoxin is a vagus nerve stimulator, that explains why people get like the AV block, right? So you see like this pattern of atrial tachycardia with an AV block. That's pretty classic for digoxin, right? But again, it's all based on that calcium. But again, this keystone detail of like the sodium calcium exchanger and all those things, many resources, for whatever reason, they just kind of gloss over it. Right? Or like, for example, another really classic one I've seen over my years as a teacher is type 2 versus type 3 hypersensitivity reactions, right? Type 2 versus type 3. You know, the type 1, the type 4, most resources hit it good. You know, they hit it and hit it good, right? Like type 1, IgE mediated, you know, anaphylaxis, allergic rhinitis, stuff like that, the end, right? Type 4, oh, T-cell mediated, delayed hypersensitivity, you know, contact dermatitis, tuberculin skin test, no problemo, right? People are usually good with those, right? But people typically don't have a good, solid, keystone understanding of type 2 versus type 3 hypersensitivity reactions. Because see, both of those kinds of hypersensitivities, they both involve antibodies. They both lead to activation of complement, right? But there is like a keystone distinction between those two. What's that keystone distinction? Well, the thing is, when you have a type 2 hypersensitivity reaction, you have an antibody attacking a cell-bound antigen. You literally have an antibody attacking an antigen that is bound to the surface of a cell. Like literally, the antigen is not going anywhere. The antigen is literally stuck to a cell surface, right? So the antibody, it goes to the cell, right? Binds to that antigen, complement gets activated, and then you destroy that cell, right? Some common examples here, right? Things like autoimmune hemolytic anemia, right? That we tend to see in people that have lupus, right? You make antibodies against red cells, right? Or Goodpasture syndrome, right? Goodpasture syndrome, it's kind of presents usually as a nephritic syndrome, but right, you're making autoantibodies against the glomerular basement membrane, right? Against the basement membrane, right? Graves' disease, you're making autoantibodies against the TSH receptor. These are all antigens that are fixed to a cell surface, right? So many times when people have these problems, when people have like Goodpasture syndrome or Graves' disease or autoimmune hemolytic anemia, their symptoms tend to be limited to the specific spot where the antigen is. Right? And that specific spot where the antigen is going to be, is going to be the specific spot where the cell that it's affixed to is, right? But compare this with a type 3 hypersensitivity reaction, right? You literally have an antibody attacking a soluble antigen that is kind of floating in the blood, right? So soluble antigen is floating in the blood, right? So this antigen is not fixed to a cell. No, it's soluble. It's floating in the blood, right? And then that antibody forms a complex with that antigen. Right? And then those things start swimming around. Because they are soluble, they can swim around, they can move around, right? These immune complexes, you can begin to deposit them in like tissues, for example, especially in small vessels, right? You get things like vasculitides, right? Or in the kidneys, you get renal failure, right? Or in joints, you get like joint involvement, right? And then in those specific spots that it gets deposited, complement gets activated, you get inflammation, you get in trouble. Right, so this is why you can have you tend to have more systemic manifestations of these problems, right? So things like serum sickness, or things like lupus, or things like post-streptococcal glomerulonephritis. If you notice, these disorders tend to be more systemic and less localized, right? So type 2 hypersensitivity reactions tend to be more localized. Type 3 hypersensitivity reactions tend to be more systemic, right? But the thing is, you may never have this understanding if you don't understand this keystone concept of, hey, right? It seems like a small point, but it's like extremely important. It seems like a small point, but it's extremely important, right? It's a point that can be glossed over. The whole point of, hey, cell-bound antigen versus soluble antigen, right? But the thing is, you'll think that if any resource is covering type 2 versus type 3, this is precisely the first thing that should be emphasized. But it's not always emphasized, right? And again, I'm telling you this, you may not realize the importance of this deep understanding. But when you get to some challenging questions, right, or you have some pathologies where it's like, man, how do I differentiate this particular pathology from this other pathology, right? You'll notice that sometimes it's these keystone levels of understanding, right? These keystone levels of understanding that can really become a game changer with regards to resolving those kinds of problems. Okay, so just be careful about that, right? Like serum sickness is like, wow, why is it that serum sickness causes, well, you're having joint issues, kidney issues, rash, right? Like a week or two after receiving a drug or an antigen. It's serum sickness, right? But again, the reason that you have those diverse systemic symptoms is because of the underlying pathophysiology, right? It's because of the underlying pathophysiology. Again, all these patterns I'm discussing relates to, again, in some way, shape, or form, you can see that they somehow trace back to emphasizing mechanisms over memorization, right? So kind of keep this at the back of your mind for exams, right? Okay, let's go to another pattern, right? Another pattern I'm going to discuss here are closely, so this is probably pattern five, are closely related pathologies, right? So like, for example, a classic one that many people screw up, right, is like, wow, hereditary angioedema versus like a regular allergic reaction, right? Like a regular allergic reaction, like regular, you know, anaphylaxis and stuff. It's like, wait, you know, because, and the USMLEs, they love to write many questions like these, right? You may see, like, if you're taking a block of like, you know, like you're taking eight blocks of questions, you may notice that two or three questions per block or more reflect this ideal, right? And then you notice that you're like, oh, and you see some people, like, again, I've worked with lots of students, right? I've taught lots of USMLE classes, right? So again, I don't just look at this from like the standpoint of general advice. No, I look at things from a very nuanced perspective, because I've seen how these seemingly small issues end up playing big roles in people not doing well on exams, right? Like, think about this, guys. If you have a systematic error that you keep making where it's like, wow, this thing is costing me two questions per block, right? On step two, you know, again, I know they're changing the format, making shorter blocks or whatever, still same number of questions. Maybe I'll talk about that in the future. But you're like, oh, I'm getting two questions wrong per block because of this systematic error. Two questions wrong per block because of this systematic error. Per block, it looks like just two questions. But aggregated over eight blocks, that's 16 questions. That's literally 5% of your exams. If you're getting 5% of the questions on your exam wrong because of one consistent pattern of error that you keep making, maybe fixing that error is worthwhile. Because remember, if you take 5% and multiply by 20, that's your whole exam. That's literally your whole exam. 16 times 20 is 320 questions, right? So guys, it's very important to keep this in mind. Like, let me give you an example of where closely related disorders can get a person in trouble, right? The USMLEs, they love to do this with hereditary angioedema versus a regular allergy, right? So like, for example, hereditary angioedema, what's the pathophase behind it? Well, the pathophase is you literally have a deficiency of C1-esterase inhibitor, right? You have a deficiency of C1-esterase inhibitor, right? So when you have a deficiency of this thing, you're going to have a few problems, because what exactly does C1-esterase inhibitor do? What does C1 inhibitor do, right? What it does is that it suppresses your complement cascade, right? It literally suppresses your complement cascade. Now, if you have a deficiency of it, your complement cascade cannot be suppressed. If your complement cascade is not suppressed, guess what? You're going to get uncontrolled activation of complement, and you're going to overproduce a ton of bradykinin. Many people do not realize this, but your complement cascade has a very, very, very strong link to bradykinin production, right? So you make a ton of bradykinin. And that bradykinin, what does bradykinin do? Bradykinin is a very potent vasodilator, right? Bradykinin is a very, very potent vasodilator, and it also increases vascular permeability. So this is why these people have the edema. This is why they have all this swelling and all these problems that they have, right? So the thing is, now contrast this with like angioedema that can arise from a regular allergy, right? Angioedema that can arise from a regular allergy, right? The thing is, when people have angioedema from a regular allergy, they will have hives. They will have urticaria. But people that have C1-esterase inhibitor deficiency, they don't have hives. They don't have urticaria. Why? Because the thing is, a regular allergic reaction is not based on bradykinin overproduction. That is like not the pathophysiology at all. No. A regular allergic reaction is going to involve things like IgE. It's going to involve things like mast cells, right? Immediate hypersensitivity. These things release histamine. Histamine causes itching. It causes hives. It causes urticaria specifically, right? But hereditary angioedema is a bradykinin-mediated problem. It is not a histamine-mediated problem, right? It is not a histamine-mediated problem. And this kind of leads me to the next part I'm going to talk about, pattern number six, right? It's a bradykinin-mediated problem. Regular allergies causing angioedema is more of a histamine-mediated problem. So it may be the same presentation, angioedema, but the pathway to get there is completely different. The pathway to get there is completely different, right? It's completely different. So the thing is, so don't be surprised, like, oh, it's like, wow, if a person has hereditary angioedema, why do we don't give them antihistamines? We don't give them epinephrine. It's not going to help. It's literally not going to help. No, the thing that's going to help is that, hey, give these people a concentrate of C1 inhibitor, right? Or give them something like icatibant, right? A bradykinin receptor antagonist, right? Or you can give them fresh frozen plasma, right? Again, the US MLEs, they love to test these things, right? They love to test these things. They love to test these things. And the thing is, again, if you don't have this understanding, right? Especially these closely related disorders, you're going to get in trouble with these questions on your test. There are some people that literally, this one pattern I've just described is the primary issue they have, right? They don't know how to differentiate closely related things because, again, the understanding of the pathophase is not there. The understanding of the pathophase is not there. The understanding of the pathophase is not there, right? So please keep that in mind. Again, you see, it goes back to the very first point I made in this podcast. That, hey, emphasize mechanisms over what? Memorization. Emphasize mechanisms over what? Memorization. Emphasize mechanisms over memorization. Again, you're like, man, Divine is saying the same thing over and over again. But the thing is, one thing I've noticed about myself is I try to not just tell people to do something. I try to explain the why behind why I'm telling you to do something. Because if you understand the why, then you're more likely to build conviction and see like, okay, this is why this truly works a certain way versus this is why this does not work, right? So like, for example, when I'm teaching my test-taking strategies class, I don't just teach people test-taking strategies. You know, like for example, you see like people have these random strategies out there. Oh, okay, if you're not sure, always pick B. Like, okay, what's the pathophysiology behind me always picking B? Does that make sense at all, right? If people really try to understand like, hey, this is why somebody is saying this, then sometimes they may be like, I'm going to completely disregard this thing this person just said because it makes no sense in logic, right? But you see, many people, they accept certain pieces of advice and think that it's completely okay, right? But it's like, man, when you really sit down and tear this thing down, you're like, wait, this thing this person is doing makes like zero sense. All right, let me get off my soapbox there. Let's go to pattern number six. What is pattern number six? Pattern number six is what I like to call the surrogate. The surrogate. The surrogate. Right? So pattern number six is what I like to call the surrogate. What do I mean by the surrogate? The USMLEs, again, they realize that the landscape of medical education and just general just prep for exams has changed quite significantly over the years, right? Anki was just coming out when I became a medical student, right? It tells you when I went to med school, right? Anki just was just coming out. I never imagined I'll be saying this. It's like, whoa, Anki was just coming out. Wow, that's crazy, right? But Anki was just coming out, right? These publicly available flashcard decks started becoming a thing, again, around when I was a medical student, right? When I started my first year of medical school, there were not many very, very big Anki decks out there. I think like the only like big Anki deck that you could kind of say, okay, this is a USMLE big Anki deck from back then, I think was this one called like, is he like Brosencephalon or something like that? you don't even hear of Bruzencephalon on Reddit or Student Doctor Network anymore, right? It's like an old-timer Anki deck, right? But it was like gold standard back then. You know, these days people think about like Zonki and Anking and all those things, right? Shout out to those guys, by the way, right? But again, like things have changed, right? But the thing is, many people do not realize that as things have changed with regards to the study resources that are available, with regards to the ways people study for exams and everything, people don't realize that the USMLEs also make adjustments, right? The USMLEs also make adjustments. And then they're like wondering like, man, I keep following these tried and true things from back in the day, but my performance is not changing. Well, the thing is, you've not made an adjustment, right? You've not made an adjustment. See, any smart person that wants to succeed in life or wants to succeed at an activity has to be able to make adjustments, right? Has to be able to make adjustments. If you cannot make adjustments, then you're going to land in trouble, right? So like, for example, I just like to think of someone like LeBron James, right? LeBron James, you can make an adjustment during a game and he'll just make his own adjustment. He'll tell his team, tell his coach that, hey, this is the adjustment they made. They're switching to a zone defense. Okay, this is how we're going to kill that zone. Or they're switching to this. This is how we're going to kill this setup. We're switching to this. This is how we're going to kill this setup. They literally have counters for those setups, right? A good basketball coach is able to literally manage the game in real time. As the opposing coach is making changes, that person is also making changes to counter those changes, right? Like literally, I've heard that LeBron can be so devious sometimes that he can make an adjustment to the adjustment to the adjustment to the adjustment that you made. He's that good, right? So the thing is, the USMLEs, they make adjustments, but people taking these exams don't make adjustments. And then they are wondering why their exam performance is not keeping in lockstep. They're like, hey, this person, this mentor of mine that took the USMLEs 5 years ago, you know, followed this exact same study strategy that I'm following and got a 270. But look at me, I'm barely cracking 230s on my practice exams. What's going on here? It's because of this pattern I'm talking about, right? This pattern of not being able to make changes. Surrogates. What do I mean by surrogates? Surrogates just mean how the USMLEs word questions and how they word answers these days, right? Literally how they word questions and how they word answers these days, right? So what do I mean by this? Like, for example, many people can probably recognize hereditary angioedema in a USMLE question. It's something you can probably pick up on pretty quickly, right? You see this, you're like, oh, okay, wow. This person, her dad, and many members of her family, you know, they have like lip swelling, they have like abdominal pain, blah, 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 blah. All right, good. Hereditary angioedema. Okay, great. You're reading the question, you're like, ah, this is hereditary angioedema. And then you're looking at the answer choices and hereditary angioedema is not a provided answer. You're like, what? Where's hereditary angioedema? And here's the thing. Hereditary angioedema is one of the answers. It's just not written point blank as hereditary angioedema, right? They would have put something completely related. Like, is hereditary angioedema, but something like that is mechanism based or like, just like an offshoot that, again, you're not thinking about, right? So like, for example, they can put bradykinin-mediated angioedema as an answer. You're like, wow, okay. But no, you think they'll just put that because, you know, many people know that, hey, in hereditary angioedema, there's a little bradykinin. No, the USMLEs, they're not going to stop there. No, what are they going to do? They can put another answer that says histamine-mediated angioedema. Guys, I'm going to tell you, again, let's tell ourselves the truth here. You're not going to see an answer that says bradykinin-mediated angioedema and an answer that says histamine-mediated angioedema and not pause and start thinking hard. You're going to start thinking hard because you're like, okay, never thought about this way, right? Or they can say prostaglandin-mediated angioedema. They'll give you a bunch of inflammatory molecules and they'll put the term mediated angioedema, mediated angioedema, mediated angioedema. And you're like, what in the world am I supposed to do here? They put a surrogate, right? That's one way you adjust, right? Because the USMLEs know that a lot of people go about things by just memorizing, right? They just believe that I'm a an Anki deck, I'm going to succeed on my exams. So they write some questions like these, where you put a surrogate. They don't put what you're looking for. They put a surrogate for it, right? So just keep that in mind as you're prepping for your exams, right? Let me give you a few more examples, right? Like, why put restless leg syndrome where you can put iron deficiency as the answer? But many people don't realize that iron deficiency has a strong association with restless leg syndrome, right? Or they can put like dopamine dysregulation as the answer to a restless leg syndrome question. Because again, dopamine dysregulation is associated with restless leg syndrome. Another classic example, malignant hyperthermia, right? The thing is, people, again, if you survey most Anki decks that talk about malignant hyperthermia, they will obviously talk about the, you know, the association with like inhaled anesthetics or succinylcholine, and then the person will develop muscle rigidity, the person is going to have high fevers and all those things. Fine, whatever. Everybody knows that. That is in every Anki deck known to mankind. But the USMLEs, that's not the approach they're going to take, right? They can ask you about pharmacotherapy, and they'll just put an answer that says calcium channel blocker. You're like, Divine, calcium channel blocker? Yes, calcium channel blocker can be the answer. You're like, Divine, that's weird. That's strange. Why are they not putting things like dantrolene? Well, dantrolene is in every Anki deck known to mankind. But how can you resolve between a medical student or an exam taker that has just memorized dantrolene versus a person that truly, truly understands the disease? Use a surrogate. They use surrogates to see if you understand the disease versus if you just memorized the disease, right? Because think about it. What's the pathophysiology behind malignant hyperthermia? It's autosomal dominant. It's a ryanodine receptor mutation. It's literally a ryanodine receptor mutation. If you have that mutation in the ryanodine receptor, you're going to release tons and tons of calcium from the sarcoplasmic reticulum. So if, wow, that receptor mutation causes you to release a lot of calcium, it means that, wow, that ryanodine receptor must be a conduit for calcium. So if you want to fix the problem, you want to block that conduit for calcium. That's literally what dantrolene does. But on the exams, why put dantrolene when you can put calcium channel blocker? When you can put calcium channel blocker, right? And then people see an answer choice that is calcium channel blocker and they're like, there is absolutely no way this can be correct, because they're only thinking about calcium channel blockers from the context of the dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers like amlodipine or nifedipine, or the non-dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers like verapamil or diltiazem, right? And in their minds, they're like, wait, this question is not about angina. This question is not about variant angina. This question is not about high blood pressure. Why should I pick a calcium channel blocker answer? And they just cross it off. But then that ends up being the right answer on the test. Again, if you notice all these different patterns I'm mentioning, what does he always end up coming back to? Mechanisms over memorization. Mechanisms over memorization, right? So guys, this podcast is kind of getting long, but I'm really trusting that in the future, I can talk about this some more, right? But I think these patterns that I've mentioned can get you really started, get you on the right path towards doing well with these kinds of concepts on your exams, right? So I know this podcast is kind of weird, it's kind of strange, but if you imbibe the lessons from this podcast, it can help you tremendously in your preparation for your exams. And if you love the way I teach, you love the way I integrate, you want to learn more about these topics I'm talking about, you're going to love my classes, right? I have a 2.5-hour test-taking class. I have a 4-hour biostats class. I have a 5-hour social sciences and ethics class, you know, quality improvement, hospital medicine. These classes are all for step 1-3, and they take place over Zoom. I have a 25-hour step 1 class, you know, that can really help you with your basic sciences. So it's not just for people taking step 1, but if you're taking step 2, step 3, and you have a poor foundation, that's a great class for you. Right? It's going to be taking place early in May, right? And then the first three classes I mentioned, I'm having them this month. And then for step 2, step 3 specifically, I have a 3-hour last minute review. I have a 20-hour step 2 class, right? Those are taking place this month. And then I have this very big, expansive, super amazing class, 50-hour class. It's going to take place in the first 2 weeks of June. So if you're interested in any of these classes, again, just shoot me an email. I'm the one that teaches these classes in their entirety over Zoom. Okay, these classes have limited spots, right? So again, if you're interested, shoot me an email. I can give you some more information. And I also offer one-on-one tutoring, and I help with, you know, mock interviews, personal statements, rec letters, and all those things, right? And again, I offer one-on-one tutoring for all the USMLE, all the Comlex exams, all the med school exams, right? So if you're interested in any of those, shoot me an email, right? And then you can listen to this podcast on the website, or divineinterventionpodcast.com, or you can go on Apple Podcasts, on Google Podcasts, on Spotify. I do have the podcast on there, right? And then I have another website called divineinterventionlifelessons.com. divineinterventionlifelessons.com. Many of you know I'm a Christ follower. I'm a Christian. So every week I post like one or two podcasts where from a biblical perspective, I address a life lesson. So divineinterventionlifelessons.com. There's actually an Apple podcast associated with that called the Divine Intervention Life Lessons Podcast. So thank you for listening to me today. Share this podcast with your friends. I promise you it will actually help not just you, but it will really, really help them. Right? So have a wonderful rest of your day. I will see you in episode, I believe, 638. God bless you and bye for now. Thank you.